were forbidden to show themselves around the civilized halls of El Patrón's mansion. Chapter 18. The Dragon Horde.
"Wake up," said Celia so close to his ear that Matt fell out of bed with his arms flailing.
"What's wrong?"
he cried, trying to untangle himself from the sheets. She yanked the sheets away and pulled him to his feet. Even though Matt was as tall as Celia now, she was stronger. It must have been all those years of lugging pots of stew around the kitchen. She pushed him into the bathroom.
"Should I get dressed?" Matt asked.
"There's no time. Just wash your face."
Matt splashed water on his face in an effort to wake up. He'd gone straight to bed after the farm patrol had brought him home. He'd felt sick from the bad air at the Egypt pens. He was disturbed by the conflicting images he had of the farm patrol. Before he had met them, Celia had filled Matt's head with enough stories to make his blood run cold. They were creatures of the night, she said, like the chupacabras. They infested the trails that wound out of the Ajo Mountains, and they hunted their prey with heat-sensitive goggles. Matt remembered Hugh's cold eyes as the man slammed him onto the bed of the truck. To Hugh, at that point at least, Matt was only a rat to be crushed underfoot. But once he'd revealed himself as Mateo Alacrán, the farm patrol had transformed themselves into good-natured boys, out for a drink at the pub, with a little head-thumping for dessert.
"Yeah, right," Matt reminded himself. "And Tom's the angel Gabriel."
"Hurry up, it's important,"
shouted Celia from the other side of the bathroom door. Matt dried his hands and emerged.
"Have a quesadilla before you go."
Was it Matt's imagination, or was Celia's hand shaking as she handed him the plate?
"I'm not hungry," he protested.
"Eat. It's going to be a long night."
Celia planted herself at the table and watched as he mechanically chewed. She made him finish every bit of it. The salsa tasted funny, or perhaps it was the after effects of the bad air. Matt still felt sick. He'd gone to bed with a metallic taste in his mouth. The minute Celia and Matt emerged from the apartment, they were met by a pair of bodyguards and hustled through the halls. It must have been very late, because all the corridors were deserted. They rushed down the front steps and along a winding path, going through darkened gardens until they reached the edge of the desert. Behind them, Matt saw the great mansion with its white pillars and orange trees decorated with lights. His bare foot crunched down on a bullhead thorn.
"Ow!"
Matt crouched down to remove the thorn. The bodyguards whisked him off the ground before he could reach his foot. Then Matt realized where they were heading.
"The hospital?"
he gasped.
"It's all right, mi vida," said Celia.
But it didn't sound all right. Her voice was choked.
I'm not sick," Matt cried.
He hadn't been to the hospital since he'd seen the thing on the bed.
"You're not sick. El patrón is," said one of the guards.
Matt stopped struggling then. It was perfectly natural for them to bring him to El Patrón. He loved El Patrón, and the old man would want to see him if he was very sick.
"What happened?" Matt said.
"Heart attack," grunted the guard.
"He's not dead?"
"Not yet." Matt suddenly felt faint with shock. His vision blurred and his heart pounded. He twisted his head away from the bodyguard's arm and vomited.
"What the?"
The man gave a startled shout followed by a string of curses.
"Crikey, look at what he did to my suit."
Matt no longer bothered about the thorn in his foot. Far worse problems overwhelmed him. His stomach felt like he'd swallowed a barrel cactus. Something was wrong with his eyes, too. The hospital walls swarmed with weird colors. Orderlies lifted him onto a stretcher, quickly wheeled him down a hall, and transferred him to a bed. Someone shouted, "His heartbeat's all over the place!" And someone else ran a needle into his arm. Matt was no longer sure of what was real, what was a nightmare. He seemed to be in the trough at the Egypt pens, floating in yellow sludge. He vomited again and again, until only a thin, bile-flavored liquid dribbled out. He saw Furball sitting at the foot of his bed, looking reproachful. Was this how Furball suffered after he'd ingested the laudanum? Then it was St. Francis who sat at the foot of the bed.
"Brother Wolf, you have done much evil, so that all folk are your enemy.
yet I would be your friend, he said.
Sure. Okay, thought Matt.
The figure of St. Francis shifted to that of Tamlin. The bodyguard looked gray and haggard. He bowed his head as though in prayer, although praying was very far from the activities Matt associated with the man.
A faint blue light illuminated the window. Dawn was approaching, and the horrors of the night were ebbing away. Matt swallowed. His throat was so raw, he wasn't sure he could speak.
Tamlin, he croaked.
The bodyguard's head snapped up. He looked, Matt couldn't quite put a name to it, both relieved and miserable.
Don't talk unless you have to, laddie.
El patron,
whispered Matt.
He's stable, said Tamlin. They had to do a piggyback transplant on him.
Matt raised his eyebrows.
That's where they put a donor heart next to his, to regulate the beat. The heart was too small to do the job by itself.
Matt understood something of the process from his science classes. When someone died in an accident, his organs were used to save the lives of sick people. If the heart El Patron got was small, it must have come from a child. Maybe that was what had depressed Tamlin.
I was at Egypt Pens,
Matt said, and paused to let the pain in his throat subside.
Got sick. Farm patrol found me.
You were in the wastelands, Tamlin exploded. Good God, no wonder your heart went wonky. There's a witch's brew of chemicals in that soil. I want you to promise me never, never to go there again.
Matt was overwhelmed by the bodyguard's anger. How was he to know where the dangers were when no one told him? His eyes began to leak tears in spite of his efforts not to appear cowardly.
Heck, I'm sorry, said Tamlin. I shouldn't yell at you when you're down. Look, you did a daft thing, nosing around the Egypt Pens. But maybe it wasn't such a bad mistake. They do say guardian angels guide the steps of idiots.
The man looked speculatively at Matt, as though he wanted to say more.
Sorry, whispered Matt.
And so you should be. Celia's been wearing a groove in the floor outside for hours. Do you feel up to a little weeping and wailing?
If you take thorn out of foot,
croaked Matt. The bodyguard yanked back the covers and found the problem at once.
Bloody idiots, he growled under his breath. Can't find anything unless it has a bullseye painted around it.
He pulled out the thorn and swabbed Matt's foot with rubbing alcohol. Matt wanted badly to ask him questions.
Do you feel sorry about killing 20 children,
for instance?
And why were you angry about Furball when you did something far worse?
But it took more confidence than Matt had to confront Tamlin. Weeping and wailing was exactly what Celia had in mind. She lamented over Matt until he felt hysterical. Still, it was nice to be loved. Even better, she stood up to the hospital orderlies like a tigress.
He's not needed here anymore,
she cried in both English and Spanish. Matt was loaded onto a stretcher and carried back through the fresh, cool dawn air to Celia's apartment. She tucked him into bed and stood guard over him for the rest of the day. El Patron's piggyback heart performed valiantly, but it was clear the old man had passed a kind of milestone. He no longer purred around restlessly in his motor-driven wheelchair. Physical therapists worked his arms and legs to keep the muscles from wasting away, but something vital had gone. Once, El Patron would have roared with laughter when Tamlin described how his enemies in the U.S. and Aztlan governments had been disgraced or met with strange accidents. Now, he merely nodded. Such pleasures were beyond El Patron now, and he had few enough left at the age of 148. Tamlin had treasures brought from the vast hoard of gifts the old man had amassed. El Patron ran his gnarled fingers through a box of diamonds and sighed.
In the end, they're only rocks.
Matt, who spent much time by El Patron's bed these days, said,
They're very beautiful.
I no longer see the life in them. The fire that made men go to war for them is gone.
And Matt understood that what El Patron missed was not the beauty of the stones, but the joy he once took in owning fine things. He felt very sorry for the old man, and didn't know how to comfort him.
St. Francis says it's good to give stuff away to the poor, Matt suggested.
The change that came over El Patron then was extraordinary. He drew himself up in the bed. His eyes flashed and energy bubbled up from some unknown reservoir.
Give things away? He cried in the voice of a man 100 years younger. Give things away? I can't believe I heard that. What have they been teaching you?
It was only a suggestion, Matt said, aghast at the reaction he'd provoked. St. Francis lived a long time ago.
Give things away, mused the old man. Was that why I fought my way out of Durango? Was that why I built an empire greater than El Dorado's? El Dorado bathed in gold dust every day. Did you know that?
Matt did. El Patron had told him at least 12 times.
He stood on the porch of his golden house, said El Patron, his black eyes shining, and his servants dusted him with metal until he shone like the sun. His people worshipped him like a god.
The old man was lost in the fantasy now, and his eyes looked far away to the jungles where the fabled king had lived. Later, Tam Lin complimented Matt on his cleverness.
Brought the roses back to his cheeks, suggesting he give away his dragon hoard. I've been too soft on him. What he really needed was a boot up the rear end.
What's a dragon hoard? Asked Matt. He and Tamlin were sitting in Celia's garden sharing a pitcher of lemonade. The bodyguard rarely had time to visit since El Patron's heart operation. Now, though, because of Matt's incautious remark, the old man was roaming around the house by himself. Tamlin said he was counting the spoons.
Ah, now, said Tamlin. That's what a dragon amasses from pillaging castles. He keeps his wealth in a deep, dark cave in the mountains, and at night he sleeps on it. It's probably uncomfortable with all those jewel-encrusted daggers and so forth, but the dragon is so covered with scales, he can't feel it.
Matt loved it when Tamlin spoke of things he must have heard as a child. A soft musical lilt came into his voice. Matt could imagine him as a boy, long before the events that had blunted his nose and reamed him with scars from head to toe.
Well, does it make the dragon happy? Matt asked.
Does it make the dragon happy? Echoed Tamlin.
Why, I never thought of that. I suppose it does. What other pleasure can a creature have whose life consists of making everyone else miserable?
To go on, though, the most amazing thing about dragons is that they know when anything, no matter how small, has been taken from their hoard. They can be in a deep slumber, but if some foolish lad creeps up in the middle of the night and takes only one coin, the dragon wakes up. You wouldn't want to be that lad then. That dragon burns him right down to a lump of coal and tosses him onto a heap with the other lumps of coal who made the mistake of trying to steal from a dragon hoard.
Bees hovered over banks of flowers in the warm afternoon sun. Normally, Celia preferred growing vegetables, but she'd recently taken an interest in flowers. Black-eyed Susans climbed one of the walls, and a passion flower vine decorated another. Foxgloves and larkspurs formed a tidy bed framed by other plants Matt didn't recognize. Some were sensitive to sunlight, so Tamlin had constructed a latticework arbor. Matt thought it made the garden much nicer.
Does El Patron know how much stuff he has in his storeroom?
Matt knew, of course, who was being referred to with the dragon story.
Probably not. But you don't want to take a chance on it, said Tamlin.
Chapter 19 Coming of Age.
El Patron's burst of energy didn't last long. Soon he was as pale and weak as ever. He rambled on about his childhood and his 7 brothers and sisters who had all died young. He listened to Matt play the guitar, although the boy's fingers weren't long enough yet to play really complicated pieces.
Matt's voice was high and sweet. An angel's voice, Celia said. El Patrón went into a quiet daze when he listened to it. Matt loved to see the old man then, with his eyes half closed and his mouth curved up in a gentle smile. It was better than any compliments. One day, as Matt was singing a Spanish ballad, his voice cracked. It dropped more than an octave to produce a sound more like a braying donkey than a boy. Embarrassed, he cleared his throat and tried again. At first the song went smoothly, but after a few moments the same thing happened again. Matt stood up in confusion.
"So, it has happened,"
murmured El Patrón from his bed.
I'm sorry. I'll ask Celia for cough drops," said Matt. "You don't know what's wrong, do you? You're so cut off from the rest of the world. You don't know.
I'll, be okay tomorrow." The old man laughed, a dry, dusty sound.
"Ask Celia or Tamlin to explain. Just play for me without singing. That's good enough."
But when Matt asked Celia later, she threw her apron over her face and burst into tears.
"What is it? What's wrong?"
cried Matt, thoroughly alarmed.
"You've grown up," wailed Celia from behind the apron.
"Isn't that okay?" Matt's voice, to his horror, boomed out like a bass drum.
"Of course it is, mi vida,"
said Celia, wiping her eyes with the cloth and putting on an unconvincing smile.
"It's always a shock when a little lamb sprouts horns and turns into a big, handsome ram. But it's a good thing, darling, really. It is. We must have a party to celebrate."
Matt sat in his room with the guitar as he listened to Celia bang pots in the kitchen. He didn't believe it was a good thing to grow up. He could read Celia's moods no matter how many smiles she produced. He knew that underneath she was upset, and he wanted to know why. He'd become a man. No, that was wrong. Since he wasn't a boy to begin with, he couldn't turn into a man. He was an adult clone. An old memory surfaced of the doctor telling Rosa that clones went to pieces when they got older. Matt no longer feared he would actually fall apart. But what did happen? Matt felt his face for the first hint of whiskers. There was nothing, except a couple of bumps left over from his last bout of acne.
"Maybe it's a mistake," he thought.
He attempted the ballad again and made it through only the first line before his throat betrayed him. It was extremely disappointing. His new voice wasn't nearly as good as the old one.
"I wonder if Maria's voice will change too," he thought.
The party that night was subdued. Celia and Tamlin sat in the courtyard with glasses of champagne to celebrate Matt's new status. As a special treat, Matt was allowed one too, although Celia insisted on watering it down with lemonade. Fireflies Matt had ordered from a catalog pulsed across the warm, humid garden. A heavy odor filled the walled-in space from Celia's new and somewhat creepy plants. She said she had ordered them from a curandera in Aztlán. A sudden thought struck Matt.
"How old am I?"
he asked, holding out his glass for a refill. Celia, ignoring a frown from Tamlin, poured him lemonade instead of champagne.
"I know I don't have a birthday like humans," Matt said, "but I was born, or something like it."
"You were harvested," said Tamlin.
His speech was slurred. He had polished off a bottle by himself, and Matt realized he'd never seen the bodyguard drink alcohol before.
"I grew inside a cow. Did she give birth to me, like a calf?"
Matt saw nothing wrong with being born in a stable. Jesus had found it perfectly acceptable.
"You were harvested,"
repeated Tamlin.
"He doesn't need the details," Celia said. "And I say he does," roared the man, slamming his fist on the picnic table.
Both Celia and Matt flinched.
"There's been enough damn secrecy around this place. There's been enough damn lies."
"Please," Celia said urgently, placing her hand on Tamlin's arm. "The cameras.
The cameras can go to blazes for all I care. Take a look, you lying, spying wretches. Here's what I think of you."
The man made an extremely rude hand gesture at the black-eyed Susan vines covering one wall. Matt had copied that gesture once and had been yelled at by Celia.
Please, if you won't think of yourself, think of us.
Celia had gone on her knees by the bodyguard's bench. She clasped her hands the way she did in prayer. Tamlin shook himself like a dog.
Ach, it's the drink talking.
He grabbed the remaining champagne bottle and hurled it against the wall. Matt heard the fragments shower over the black-eyed Susans.
I'll tell you this much, lad.
He hauled Matt up by the front of his shirt. Celia watched with a pale, frightened face.
You were grown in that poor cow for 9 months, and then you were cut out of her. You were harvested. She was sacrificed. That's the term they use when they kill a poor lab animal. Your stepmother was turned into ruddy T-bone steaks.
He dropped Matt, and Matt backed away out of reach.
It's all right, Tamlin, Celia said gently.
She eased onto the seat beside him.
It's not all right.
The man buried his head in his arms on the table.
We're bloody lab animals to this lot. We're only well treated until we outlive our usefulness.
They won't get their way forever, Celia whispered,
putting her arms around him. Tamlin twisted his head until he could peer at her from the shelter of his arms.
I know what you've got in mind, and it's too dangerous, he said.
Celia leaned against him and rubbed his back with her large, gentle hands.
This farm has been here for 100 years. How many Egypts do you think are buried under the poppies?
Thousands. Hundreds of thousands.
Tamlin's voice was almost a groan.
Don't you think that's enough?
Celia smiled at Matt as she rubbed the bodyguard's back. It was a real smile this time, and it made her beautiful in the shadowy green light.
Go to bed, mi vida, she said. I'll look in on you later.
Matt was annoyed that the two seemed to have forgotten it was his party, his coming of age. He sulked in his bedroom. He twanged the guitar, hoping the noise would disturb the pair huddled in the garden. But after a while, his anger faded away. It was replaced by a feeling that he had overlooked something important.
Hints had been as thick as fireflies in the courtyard garden. They brightened with promise. They stayed alight almost long enough to show Matt what they were, but then, like the fireflies, they vanished.
Tamlin and Celia were far too careful.
It had been like that for years.
Matt knew there was vital information he was missing. It had to do with clones. He wasn't supposed to know how they were made. He wasn't supposed to know that all of them, except for him, were brain dead. Now, for the 100th time, Matt thought about why anyone would create a monster. It couldn't be to replace a beloved child. Children were loved, and clones were hated. It couldn't be to have a pet. No pet resembled the horrible, terrified thing Matt had seen in the hospital. Matt remembered Mr. McGregor and El Patron sitting in adjoining wheelchairs after their operations.
Got me new liver,
McGregor had said, patting his stomach.
Went in for a set of kidneys while I was at it.
He'd looked at Matt with those bright blue eyes that were so much like Tom's, and Matt had been revolted.
No, it couldn't be.
Matt remembered the birthday party where El Patron had so suddenly recovered his mental abilities.
Fetal brain implants. I must try that sometime, McGregor had said. It's done wonders for you. Don't put it off too long, El Patron had replied. You have to give the doctors at least 5 months lead time. 8 is better. It couldn't be.
Matt pressed his hands against his temples to keep the idea inside. If he didn't think it, it wouldn't be real. But it slipped through his fingers anyway. McGregor had created a clone, so he could have transplants when he needed them. The thing in the hospital had every reason to howl. And what was the source of El Patron's fetal implants, or the piggyback heart that kept his old leaky one going?
The evidence was all there.
Only Matt's blindness had kept him from seeing the truth, and his unwillingness to think about it. He wasn't stupid. The clues had been there all along. The truth had been too overwhelming to bear. El Patrón, too, had created clones to provide himself with transplants. He was exactly the same as MacGregor. No, not the same. Because I'm different, Matt thought desperately, staring up at the ceiling of his bedroom. Celia had pasted glow-in-the-dark stars all over the surface. From the time Matt had moved into her apartment, he'd gone to sleep under a faintly shining canopy of stars. Their presence soothed and comforted him now.
I'm different. I wasn't created to provide spare parts.
El Patrón had refused to let the doctors destroy Matt's brain. He'd protected him and given him Celia and Tam Lin for company. He'd hired Mr. Ortega to teach Matt music. The old man took great pride in the boy's accomplishments. That was not the behavior of someone who planned to murder you later. Matt consciously slowed his breathing. He'd been panting like a bird trapped inside a room. Matt had seen birds die of panic when they couldn't beat their way through a closed window. He had to think the situation through, reason it out. It was clear, whatever had happened to the other poor clones, that Matt wasn't meant to be one of them. El Patrón was moved by a motive very different from MacGregor's. It was, the boy realized, simple vanity. When the old man looked at Matt, he saw himself. Young, strong, and sound of mind. It was like looking into a mirror. The effect wouldn't be the same if Matt were a drooling, blubbering thing on a hospital bed. Matt clutched the pillow the way he'd hugged stuffed animals before he was too old for such things. He felt like he'd been yanked back from a high cliff. There was still the terrible fate of the other clones to consider.
My brothers, thought Matt.
He trembled as he tried to recall his devotion to the man who had created him. El Patrón loved him, but he was evil. A more evil, vicious, and self-serving man could hardly be imagined, Esperanza had written in her book on the land of opium. Matt had hurled the book away violently when he read that. But Matt had been a boy then. He was a man now, or something like it. Men, Tam Lin often told him, had the courage to look things in the eye.
You have a fever, cried Celia when she and Tam Lin came to say goodnight.
She hurried off to make herbal tea. Tam Lin stood and watched from the doorway. The silhouette of the bodyguard looked menacing, and Matt remembered he'd killed 20 children with a bomb intended for the English Prime Minister. The man seemed to soak up the faint starlight from the ceiling. When Celia returned with the tea, Tam Lin shrugged and said,
In answer to your question, lad, you're 14 years old.
Then he was off to his room in El Patrón's heavily guarded wing of the house. Chapter 20 Esperanza. Matt woke up sick and feverish. He felt as if a boulder was resting on his chest. The only way he could roll it off would be to learn that his fears were unfounded. He could ask Celia, but she'd be afraid to answer. Matt felt the pressure of unseen eyes on him. Someone could be watching through the cameras, or the spy room might be empty. He had no way of knowing. Felicia could be in there, wrapped in a fur coat, eagerly searching for a way to destroy him. As for asking Tam Lin, Matt didn't know how to bring up the subject. By the way, is anyone planning to cut me up into T-bone steaks? Even more terrifying was the bodyguard's possible answer.
You hit the nail on the head there, laddie. I always said you were bright as a button.
How much truth could he endure? Matt's mood lightened, though, after getting up. A hot shower and a breakfast of French toast helped drive away the fear. It made no sense for El Patrón to lavish education on someone who was valued only for his spare parts. Transplants didn't need straight A's. Matt went to the stables and ordered a safe horse. A ground fog hung over the poppy fields as he rode through. It was common in the early morning, when the water sprinklers misted the cool air next to the soil. The sun would burn it off later, but now it formed a milky sea that reached halfway up Matt's legs as he sat astride the horse. It was a wonderful feeling to move through this fog with only the horse's back and head showing. It was like swimming through an enchanted lake.
I'm 14 years old, Matt thought. I'm an adult. It made him feel strong and adventurous. Medieval princes went to war when they were 14, or even younger. The oasis was shadowy and cool. Recent rains had filled the pool until it lapped at the edge of the grape arbor. Matt dragged the metal chest to higher ground. He took off his clothes and stepped into the water. Tamlin, who let Matt do quite a few dangerous things, had discouraged swimming here because the bottom was murky with unexpected depths. To Matt, the danger was part of the attraction. He dog-paddled across the pool. Shoals of tiny fish darted away from his hands. He reached the shore and pulled himself onto a rock by a creosote bush. He shivered slightly. The day would soon heat up, but for now, the desert air was chill with night. Matt looked up at the sky. It was such an intense blue, it almost hurt his eyes. The rain had washed out the dust, leaving the air so clean and pure that it was like breathing in light. The sense of enchantment grew stronger. What was to keep him from climbing these mountains and going south to Aztlan? It was a poor country, according to Celia, and yet her face lit up when she spoke of it. It was full of people and life, too. It was a new world, where he might escape the cameras and the malice of Felicia. He wouldn't have to meet MacGregor with his patchwork of body parts. But would he want to live without Celia and Tamlin? Or Maria? Matt's spirits rose still higher as he thought about traveling those gray-brown mountains. He didn't have to make the decision yet. El Patron could live for years, would live for years, the boy assured himself. After all, the old man had the finest doctors in the world. Matt could plan his move carefully, perhaps even take Maria with him. The sick fears of the previous night had vanished, and he felt like a king. Matt the Conqueror. He swam back across the water. The sun was beginning to flood the little valley as he unpacked Tamlin's books and maps. Now he saw the use of them, and he intended to study them carefully for his future escape. "The history of opium," he read in Esperanza's book, "is soaked in terror and blood." Matt settled against a roll of blankets with a slice of cold French toast. He still found the author's preachy manner annoying, but he couldn't argue with her facts. Mateo Alacrán, or El Patrón, as he soon came to be known, planted opium from the Pecos River to the Salton Sea, Matt read. He needed a vast workforce to tend it. This was no problem, as thousands of Mexicans flooded across the border every day. All he needed was to trap them. To this end, he established the first farm patrol. He recruited his army from the foulest criminals ever vomited up by corrupt prison systems anywhere in the world. Matt slammed the book shut. There she went again with a tirade against El Patrón. Esperanza had to be a complete witch. He drank a bottle of juice he'd brought from the house and tried again. Even so, El Patrón found it hard to control the illegals. They slipped through his fingers. They helped one another escape. They flooded across opium to the border of the United States until that government threatened to put El Patrón out of business. It was then the despot of dope, fearful of losing his slave empire, came up with Egypt's. On the surface, Matt read, nothing could have seemed more humane. After all, what is suffering but an awareness of suffering? The Egypts felt neither cold, nor heat, nor thirst, nor loneliness. A computer chip in their brains removed those sensations. They toiled with the steady devotion of worker bees. As far as anyone could tell, they were not unhappy. So could anyone say they were being mistreated? I could, thundered Esperanza. El Patrón sold those people's souls to the devil. When they died, he plowed their bodies into the dirt for fertilizer. The roots of opium are watered with blood, and anyone who buys its foul weed is no better than a flesh-eating cannibal. That was definitely enough reading for one day. Matt rested the book on his chest and tried to picture Esperanza's face. She was probably covered with warts like an old witch. She'd have yellow fangs and cheeks that collapsed in like a rotten pumpkin. He flipped through the book, looking for her photo. On page 247, he found it. She was dressed in a black suit with a pearl necklace.
Her black hair hung in a shiny veil on either side of her pale and beautiful face. She looked a lot like Maria. Matt read the blurb under the picture. Esperanza Mendoza, the ex-wife of Senator Mendoza, is a charter member of the Anti-Slavery Society of California. She has written numerous best-selling books. She was a recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize and... Matt dropped the book. Maria couldn't possibly know about this. She thought her mother was dead. Esperanza had walked out of the house when Maria was 5 years old and never returned. The little girl imagined her mother had gotten lost in the desert, and she woke up night after night crying that she could hear her mother's voice. That was why Maria clung so desperately to keepsakes. She was terrified of losing the things she loved. And all this time, her mother had been living it up in California. Matt felt a deep, burning rage against the woman, and against Senator Mendoza, too. He certainly knew what had happened, but he'd preferred to let Maria suffer. Well, Matt wasn't going to let the situation go on any longer. The next time Maria visited, and she'd have to come to Stephen and Emilia's wedding in 2 months, Matt would hit her between the eyes with this evidence. Matt discovered the reason Tamlin had forbidden him to swim at the oasis. That night he came down with the worst stomach flu he could ever remember. He spent hours retching into a bucket until his throat burned like fire. Celia insisted on treating him herself. She forced glass after glass of milk down him, and she didn't leave him alone for a second. In the periods between attacks, he noticed that her hands were as cold and clammy as his own. Finally, he recovered enough to lie down. Celia pulled a chair up by his bed and sat there all night while Matt drifted in and out of sleep. At one point, he woke to find Tamlin's face only an inch from his own. The bodyguard straightened up and said, "His breath smells of garlic." Why wouldn't it smell of garlic? Matt thought drowsily. Practically everything Celia cooked was loaded with it. "I warned you not to try this. We have to talk," said Tamlin to Celia. "I'll get the dosage right next time," she said. "Do you want to ruin everything? Maybe your plan won't work out. We need a backup," Celia said. "You'll kill him." She looked up at the secret camera. "I'd die rather than let that happen." The voices stopped. Matt tried to stay awake to see whether they would reveal more, but he was too weak. The illness left Matt nervous and headachy for days. Just when he thought he was getting better, another bout of nausea occurred. The second attack wasn't as bad as the first, so it seemed he was fighting off the disease. He did wonder why Celia didn't call for the doctor, but he was grateful at the same time. It would have meant a trip to the hospital, and Matt wanted to avoid that at all costs. When he had recovered sufficiently, he resumed spending his days at El Patron's side, listening to the old man ramble. It seemed that a fog was gradually enveloping El Patron's memories. He sometimes called Matt by another name, and he was confused about other things, too.
"I built this shack with my own hands," he told Matt.
Matt looked around. The last thing you'd call the mansion with its gardens and fountains was a shack.
"I put in the grapevine, too," El Patron said. "It's doing very well. It covered the arbor in only 2 years. I think it's the water. There's nothing finer than one of these desert pools." "He's talking about the oasis," Matt thought with a chill. El Patron must have been the person who had lived there long ago. The shack had fallen down, but the grapevine was still doing very well.
"Is that the place behind the hole in the rock?" Matt asked, to be sure he was correct.
"Of course, Felipe," El Patron snapped. "You climb through that hole every single day."
He fell into another reverie, his eyes seeing things no one else could.
"This is the most beautiful place in the world," he said with a sigh. "If there's a heaven, and I'm allowed inside, I'm sure this pool and grapevine will be there."
Then he wandered off into an even older memory. El Patron's voice filled with wonder as he described the hacienda where he had attended fiestas so long ago.
They had a fountain, El Patrón marveled. The water sounded like music, and there was a statue of a little angel in the middle. He looked so cool and clean. And you can't imagine the food, Felipe. Tamales, as many as you wanted, and barbecued ribs. There were chiles rellenos and moro crabs flown in from Yucatán, and a whole table of caramel puddings, each with its own little dish.
Matt felt sure that if there was a heaven, it contained moro crabs flown in from Yucatán, and a table covered with caramel puddings. But then El Patrón's voice became sad.
Mama brought my little sisters to the fiesta. She carried one, and the other held onto her skirt and followed behind. My little sisters caught typhoid and died in the same hour. They were so small, they couldn't look over the windowsill. No, not even if they stood on tiptoe.
It struck Matt that El Patrón was a lot nicer when he remembered the past. He seemed kinder and more vulnerable. Matt still loved the old man, but there was no question he was evil. "Who's Felipe?" Matt asked Celia in the large, wood-burning kitchen of the mansion. "You mean the sauce cook or the gardener?" she said. "It must be someone else. El Patrón's always calling me that."
"Oh, no,"
murmured Celia, pausing from the pie dough she was rolling out. "Felipe was his son. He died almost 80 years ago."
"Then why?"
"Some people are like that, mi vida. First they get older and older, and then they stop and get younger and younger. El Patrón believes he's about 35 years old now, so he thinks you're his son, Felipe. He can't possibly know who you really are."
"Because I won't exist for another 100 years.
"That's right," replied Celia.
"So what should I do?"
"Be Felipe for him," Celia said simply.
Matt went to the music room and played the piano to calm his nerves. If El Patrón's mind was slipping, it meant he was ready for another dose of fetal brain implants. That meant an embryo, Matt's brother, was growing inside a cow. Could embryos understand death? Could they be afraid? Matt crashed into a rendition of the Turkish March by Mozart, playing loud enough to make a servant drop a tray in the hallway outside. When Matt finished, he played it again, and again. The orderliness of Mozart made him feel as though he had control of his own life. It transported him beyond the stifling world of the mansion. More and more he wanted to escape. Once the possibility had occurred to him at the oasis, the longing returned until it became a constant ache. He felt trapped like a worm in a nut. Esperanza's book had opened his eyes to the horrors of the empire El Patrón had built, and he had seen for himself the low, dark dwellings of the Ejits that were no better than coffins. He could run away through the gray-tinged mountains that ring the oasis. He could go to Aztlán. Tamlin had given him a chestful of maps and food for that very reason. Matt was sure of it. But he couldn't leave before Stephen and Emilia's wedding. Maria would be there, and he couldn't go without seeing her.
Chapter 21. Blood Wedding. The mansion seethed with activity. Potted orange trees were dragged in and placed around the perimeter of the salon. The scent of their flowers filled the house. The gardens were planted with jasmine, honeysuckle, and baby's breath. So many powerful perfumes made Matt queasy. His stomach hadn't felt right since his swim at the oasis. The freezers adjoining the kitchen filled up with ice sculptures. Mermaids, lions, castles, and palm trees swirled with mist when Matt looked inside. They would be placed in bowls of punch for the wedding reception. The old curtains and rugs were packed away, and new ones in white, pink, and gold took their place. The walls were repainted, the red tile roofs cleaned and polished. The house began to look like a giant birthday cake covered with frosting. Matt skirted around the edge of these festivities. He knew he'd be confined to Celia's apartment during the party. Big deal, thought Matt, scuffing his shoes along a newly laid stretch of white carpet. He didn't want to go to the stupid wedding anyway. Everyone had known for years that Stephen and Emilia were going to get married. El Patrón had decreed it. He wanted to bind the Alacrans to the powerful political machine Senator Mendoza ruled in the United States. It was simply good luck that Stephen and Emilia liked each other. If they hadn't, it wouldn't have mattered. Benito, Stephen's older brother, had married the daughter of the Nigerian president because Nigeria was one of the richest countries in the world. Benito and Fanny, his bride, had loathed each other on sight. But El Patrón liked Nigerian money, so their opinions didn't count. As the day drew near, Matt felt more and more isolated. Celia was too distracted to talk. Tamlin was shut away with El Patrón, whose health was too poor to allow visits. Matt could have gone to the oasis, but a strange tiredness had come over him. He fell asleep early, only to find his nights disturbed by evil dreams. By day his mouth tasted of metal, and his head ached. He made only one brief trip to fetch Esperanza's book on opium. The house filled up with guests. McGregor arrived with a new wife, number 7. Matt thought, this one was as young as Emilia. And Felicia consumed so much alcohol that a cloud of whiskey followed her wherever she went. She drifted from one garden party to another, staring at people with bright, feverish eyes, until they became uncomfortable and moved away. As for McGregor, he was in fine spirits. He'd had hair transplants. His scalp was a riot of springy red hair, just like Tom's, and he kept patting it as though it might fall out if he didn't push the roots back in. Matt observed everything from behind pillars or wall hangings. He didn't want anyone to point at him and say, "What's this? Who brought this creature into a place for people?" On the day of the wedding, a Nigerian hovercraft landed, carrying Benito, Fanny, and Stephen. Mr. Alagran greeted them and kissed Fanny, who grimaced as though she'd touched something nasty. She had a hard, bitter face, and Benito was beginning to get a pot belly. Stephen, on the other hand, was as handsome as a storybook prince. Matt disliked him less than the other Alacrans. It was Stephen who had carried him away from the little house in the poppies, and if he and Emilia had ignored Matt since, neither had they been cruel. Matt watched the milling crowd of guests and recalled their names, business connections, and scandals. He thought he understood the Alacrán Empire every bit as well as Stephen. For the 100th time, Matt felt the gulf that separated him from humanity. All these people were here to honor Stephen. No one would ever honor Matt, nor would he ever marry. A familiar hovercraft landed, and Matt's heart leapt to his throat. The guests turned toward the landing pad and craned their necks to see the bride. Emilia didn't disappoint them. She was dressed in a shimmering blue gown, surrounded by a cluster of little girls as attendants. Each carried a basket of rose petals, which she tossed in handfuls at the crowd. Matt thought they made a pretty picture, until he realized the little girls were Egypts. Everyone applauded as the bride was led up the stairs to the salon by Senator Mendoza, but Matt had no eyes for them. The only person he cared about stepped out of the hovercraft without any fanfare at all. No one noticed Maria slip through the crowd, or that she wasn't going in the same direction as her sister. Matt understood, though, and he worked his stealthy way around the edge of the crowd to the music room. Most people shunned the music room. The servants entered only when they cleaned, and Felicia had stopped playing altogether. The room was Matt's territory, and thus tainted. He closed the door behind him and went straight to the closet. Maria was waiting in the secret passage.
"At last," she cried, flinging her arms around him. "Have you missed me?"
"All the time," he said, hugging her back. "I thought about you every day. I wanted to write, but I didn't know how."
"I'm in an awful convent," she said, disengaging herself and flopping down on the floor. "Oh, it's not too bad. I just don't fit in. I wanted to do charity work in the town, but the sisters wouldn't let me. Imagine, they think they follow the teachings of St. Francis, but they'd curl up and die rather than wash a beggar's sores."
"I wouldn't like to wash a beggar's sores either," said Matt.
"That's because you're a wolf. You'd gobble him up instead."
"I'd find a healthy beggar first," Matt said.
"You're not supposed to eat any of them.
Tell me what you've been up to. Gosh, the other girls are boring. They don't do anything but read love comics and eat chocolates.
Maria snuggled against Matt, and he felt amazingly good. He realized he was happy, and that he hadn't been for a long time.
Love comics? He inquired.
Wolves wouldn't find them interesting. Tell me what you've been watching on TV. We aren't allowed TV unless a show improves our souls.
I don't have a soul, Matt said.
I think you do, said Maria. I've been reading modern church doctrine about ecology. According to recent studies, people think St. Francis was the first ecologist. They say he preached to animals because they had little souls that could grow into big ones. With work, even a sparrow or a cicada could make it into heaven.
Or hell, said Matt.
Don't be negative.
And then Maria was off with her new ideas and the arguments she'd had with the morals instructor at the convent. She moved on to how she liked gardening, but hated harvesting the poor little plants, and how she was top in math, but had her grades lowered when she sunbathed naked on the roof. She seemed to have stored up months of conversation and couldn't wait to let it all out. Matt didn't care. He was content to sit there in the dark with her head leaning against his chest.
Oh, but I've done all the talking and haven't let you say a word, Maria cried at last. That's one of the things I do penance for all the time, except that no one at the convent listens to me like you do.
I like listening to you, Matt said.
I'm going to shut up now, and you're going to tell me what you've been doing.
She put her arms around him, and he smelled her perfume, a warm and somehow exciting scent of carnations. Matt never wanted to move again. He told her about the Egypt pens, and meeting the farm patrol, and how he had to go to the hospital. Maria trembled when he told her about El Patron's heart attack.
He's so old, she murmured. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but he's too old.
I don't think his piggyback heart is going to last, Matt said.
He shouldn't have one at all, Maria said.
Do you know where he got it?
Maria seemed confused. I'm not supposed to talk about it, but yes, I do know where he got it. And it's evil.
She hugged Matt more tightly. He didn't know what to say. The fears he'd thrust away came back. He wanted to ask Maria what she meant, but he was afraid of the answer. I'm not like the other clones, he said, more to reassure himself than anything. El Patron gave me the best education anyone can have. He bought me musical instruments, computers, anything I wanted, and he's really pleased when I get an A or play a new piano piece. He says I have genius. Maria said nothing. She snuggled her face into his chest, and from the dampness, Matt guessed she was crying.
Great. What is she crying about?
He wouldn't bother, Matt stepped very carefully over this point, if I wasn't going to live very long.
That's true,
she said in a watery voice. Of course it's true, said Matt firmly. I've had better schooling than Stephen. Someday I can help him run the estate. From behind the scenes, of course. Opium is a big country, and it takes a lot of work to control it. Benito's too dumb, and Tom is, well, a lot of things. For starters, El Patron can't stand the sight of him. Maria stiffened.
He likes him better than you think.
Tom doesn't even belong in the family. He's here only because El Patron refuses to give things up once he's laid claim to them.
That's a lie, Maria said hotly. Tom's one of the heirs, and he's not stupid.
I never said he was stupid, only corrupt.
He's considered good enough to marry me, Maria said.
What?
Matt couldn't believe what he was hearing. Maria was only a kid. She wouldn't get married for years and years.
Oh, let's not fight, Maria said miserably. None of us has a choice in the matter. I mean, look at Benito and Fanny. Fanny said she'd rather drink cyanide than marry Benito, and see how much good it did her. El Patron gave the order, and her father drugged her until she didn't know what was happening.
Matt was incapable of speech. How could anyone want Maria to marry Tom? He was such a rotten little pustule. It was unthinkable. He turned on the flashlight he always left in the passage and leaned it against the wall. He could see her pale face in the shadows.
Stephen and Emilia like each other, and I don't mind Tom. Much. He's getting more like MacGregor, but
I can change him.
You can't change Tom, Matt said.
Patience and love can do anything,
Maria said.
Anyhow, the wedding won't take place for years. Maybe El Padrón will change his mind.
She didn't sound hopeful. Matt's mind was almost numb with despair. He'd refused to think about the future. He knew on some level that Maria would have to marry someday. Then he'd never see her again. But it had never, in his darkest moments, occurred to him that she'd be handed over to that monster.
Wait, he said as an idea came to him. I have something for you.
A present?
Maria looked surprised. Matt fished a history of opium from its hiding place. He turned to page 247 and shone the flashlight directly on Esperanza Mendoza's portrait. Maria gasped.
Mother?
You remember what she looked like?
Dada has pictures.
She took the book and stared at the portrait and its accompanying biography as though she'd been turned to stone.
Mother got the Nobel Peace Prize,
she whispered at last. And a lot more, said Matt.
But she never came back.
Maria's face looked so forlorn, Matt's heart turned over. She couldn't, dearest, said Matt, unconsciously using one of Celia's words. She's utterly and completely opposed to opium and everything your father stands for. Do you think he'd let her come home? Or that El Padrón would? In fact, Matt silently realized El Padrón was capable of ordering her death. It wouldn't have been the first time he'd gotten rid of an enemy.
She never even wrote me a letter,
murmured Maria. Don't you see? Your father would have destroyed any message she sent. But you can contact her now. Your convent, where is it?
In Aztlán, at the mouth of the Colorado River. It's in a town called San Luis.
I've read your mother's book, said Matt, taking a history of opium from Maria's cold hands and laying it on the floor. He held her hands to warm them up. She says the Aztlanos don't like opium and would do anything to destroy it. Someone at the convent could send a message to your mother. I'm sure she wants to find you. I'm sure she'll keep you from marrying Tom. And take you where I'll never see you again, thought Matt with a lump in his throat. But it didn't matter. He was going to lose her in any case. The important thing now was to save her.
I have to go, Maria said suddenly. Emilia will be asking for me.
When will I see you again?
The wedding's tomorrow and I won't have a second to myself. I'm maid of honor. Will you be able to come?
Matt laughed bitterly. Maybe if I disguise myself as an Egypt flower girl.
I know. It's horrible. I asked Emilia why she couldn't have real children, and she said they couldn't be depended on to do the job right.
You know I won't be invited, said Matt.
Everything's so unfair, Maria sighed. If I could, I'd skip the wedding and stay with you.
Matt was touched by her offer, although he knew there wasn't a chance of it happening. I'll wait for you here, he said. Do you want to take the book?
No. I can't guess what Dada would do if he found it.
She gently kissed him on the cheek, and Matt kissed her back. The feel of her skin stayed on his lips for a long time after she was gone. It wasn't a front row seat, but it was the best he could do. Matt was positioned behind the people with a pocket telescope. He had hoped to find the machine room deserted, but the place was packed. Every view screen had at least two gorilla-like bodyguards watching it. They flicked restlessly from scene to scene and spent a lot of time studying boring places, like the spaces behind pillars or curtains. Matt wondered whether they'd seen him hiding there on other occasions. But as the wedding ceremony drew closer, the men's attention was concentrated on the salon. An altar had been erected, and the priest was prowling back and forth to one side. The Egypt choir was lined up like mechanical toys, and someone was sitting at Matt's piano. Matt adjusted the eyepiece of the telescope. It was awkward to use it at a peephole, and his neck was beginning to ache. He saw Mr. Ortega. He felt sorry for the dusty little man. He'd gone beyond Mr. Ortega's skill level long ago, but Matt had covered for him. He feared the music teacher would suffer the same fate as Rosa if El Padrón found out. On another screen, Matt saw El Padrón sitting in the front row, attended by Tamlin and Daft Donald, looking bunchy in suits. Emilia waited in a dressing room. She wore a white gown with a long train embroidered with pearls and carried by the girl Egypts.
Celia had said the gown had been owned by a Spanish queen 300 years before. The Egypt's faces reminded Matt